Bonnie and Friends. Bonnie Simon. Jacaranda FM.
I forgot if I even wanted to do this because I was doing, I had other motivations all of a sudden. And then when we finally figured out it was a good idea to pursue it, the English record company we were signed to with the second record chopped it overseas to the US. And there was a band already called Tree there in Boston, and they were a punk band. And we want to be Tree, and we want to get tree.com, the domain. And we approached this band, can we use this name? Can we pay you maybe for the rights to the name? Because that's how Americans work, right? And they said, no, it was too late. They already had Tree tattooed on their arms, and they were like, all their website pictures were this. And it was like, too late, pal. So the Tree 63 CD, if you turn it on the spine, you see it says Tree 63. It looked like one word. So the record company at the time said, well, why don't you just call it Tree 63? And okay. And to this day, it's always a bit of a sore point for me because we really are just Tree. Mm-hmm. That's more of a something that came later, but it's okay. It's part of our identity. It's good.
Yeah. And also when overseas, when radio stations interviewed you and stuff like that, where does the 63 come from,
yeah,
right? So, you know.
Absolutely. It's a talking point. You know, but at the time, Blink 182 had come out.
Yeah.
And there was another band, some 41, and suddenly all these bands had numbers, and we felt like, we jumped on the bandwagon.
Anyway. Okay, so what happened then? You got the call from the States. I mean, do you remember when the call came and, guys, you're going to have to pack your bags? Yeah. Was it Nashville? You had to go to Nashville? Yeah. Or was it Canada?
No, Nashville.
Okay, so Nashville, yeah. Tennessee. Yeah. Who organized that for you? How did that happen?
Well, like I said, we were signed to a UK Christian label. And they had relationships with the U.S. guys. And so they just shopped us across as part of a deal. And the U.S. guys took some time. We found the right partners. Eventually they said, okay, well, we'd like you to come over and talk to you. And the guy actually flew out to Durban and saw us play, and he was really pursuing us. Yeah. But when the moment where it suddenly hit me that we're actually going to go to America, and like I'm at heart still a little guy from Durban. That's really who I still am. You know.
I just want to know, Shark supporter?
Absolutely.
Okay, carry
on. The thought of getting on a plane and going to America, it was this massive thing to think this can actually happen to me. I mean, I've done it so many times now, it's weird. But at the time, I still remember how it felt. Can this really happen? Can I go to America? You know, this big idea of what America was. And it happened, and here we are.
So did they set up everything? Did you stay in a house together? Did you record there? How did it work, the infrastructure?
What happened was the American label, we had two albums out, and what they wanted to do was introduce us to America, the way they did with Depeche Mode. Depeche Mode had five albums out before they really got across to Americans with the Black Celebration record and Music for the Masses. So with us, they tried to compile the best of the two records, and they wanted us to go over to the States and re-record some of the ones that didn't sound so good. You have to be able to Americanize them a little bit because it sounded too European for them. Mm. And we spent a week in this house down south of Nashville. It was beautiful. It was summer in America, first time in America. It was very, very special time, you know. And we recorded every day and walked around these American streets and bought American stuff, and it was amazing.
Hamburgers and donuts. hot dogs, sorry. Ketchup.
Yeah, exactly.
And who was the producer then? Did they use an American producer?
No, a guy. There's fairly, in fact, a very well-known CCM, Christian Contemporary Pop Rock band, who were actually Australian. And they called the Newsboys, and they were huge in America then, and they're even bigger now. And it was them who had kind of got us involved. It was their thing to get us to get foreign bands from Australia, New Zealand, South Africa into America. Mm. And their lead singer owned the label, and he produced us. But to some degree, Tree's always been self-produced. Mm. We always go in with a clear idea of what we're doing anyway. You know?
So you are classified as a rock band. And let's just talk about the religious side of this, you know, the Christian band thing.
Yeah.
You guys weren't reborn Christians, eh?
Well, in a way, yes. But this is where this whole thing has always been quite contentious to answer this question, because Tree 63 is always perceived as a Christian band, and so you assume the guys in the band are these Christians forever. Mm. But I only became a Christian in my mid-20s. Before that, I had a long history of rock and roll and the Roxy.
Okay.
So I walked into this thing with absolutely zero idea that Christian music as a genre even existed. I had no idea. I just started singing about God and about the ideas of these theological things that I was feeling and spiritual things. And And they were real to me as a guy. Not I wasn't joining a church and or trying to push an agenda with somebody. I was just a songwriter who suddenly felt this was important to me, right? The same way Bob Dylan did the three albums and he peed everyone off by singing about Jesus. Mm. And they were like, how can the savior of folk protest rock, a Jewish guy, suddenly be singing about Jesus? It was the same sense of, I didn't care. I just wanted to sing about something that meant something to me, right? Mm. And the course of the years that followed, we got labeled, oh, Tree is this Christian band. And we've had to deal with that ever since. But essentially, we were guys who really just took the spiritual side of things very seriously and for personal reasons, not to try and shove it down radio stations' throats. You know?
But the Christian radio stations, there are many in America.
Yeah, yeah.
And you did very well there, got a lot of airplay, but not only on the Christian stations, on the rock stations as well. You had that nice crossover.
Especially here. That was the weirdest thing for me, is that the other station that you used to know.
Yeah.
They're suddenly playing Tree songs. And lyrically, some of the songs were quite blatantly spiritual or Christian or biblical even. And I'm going, how did the song get mainstream national airplay when it's so obviously not sex, drugs, and rock and roll?
Mm.
But obviously the music spoke for itself, and that was something I've always been very proud of with Tree. It doesn't matter. You don't have to be a Christian to like the band. You know?
I also think your songs were very inspirational. You know what I mean? It's like the U2 songs.
Exactly.
You know, you don't have to be a Christian to enjoy their music, you know.
Yeah.
But then you get all these death metal Christian bands. I know it sounds weird.
No, totally.
And there they are on stage. That's the way they spread the gospel, and they feel good about it, you know.
Even modern bands like Flyleaf, I mean, they're pretty heavy.
Yeah.
And we met them backstage, and they were like the sweetest little Christian guys on stage. They're just raucous, you know.
Mm. We're going to talk about Nashville, the biggest shows you've done there, the people that you met, and the big award that you won. It's like a Grammy Award, and a lot of people don't know about that. So that's all happening, and then John's going to play another song, a cover version of an Erasure song. Close your eyes and ears now. Jacaranda FM, my in-studio guest, John Ellis. And somebody says, hi, Barney, great show. Yay!
Yes!
The one listener I have. Hi, Mom.
He's my fan.
I'd like to hear John do Hotel California from Johan.
She's like.
You know, let's just see if you know the chord.
On a dark desert, cool wind in my hair.
Hang on, this song's about 8 verses long.
Yes, no, we haven't got time for an 8-minute song.
But if he pays 20 rand per verse.
We're going to talk about that. It's called the Kickstarter.
Yes.
You're going to remind me to discuss that towards the end of the show.
Yeah.
So there you were in America, and then obviously you got involved with a lot of shows, the small venues. What was the best show you ever did, a night you'll never, ever forget, a small, intimate show you guys did?
Jeez. It sounds a rock star thing to say, but at some point there were so many shows. It was such a blur of shows. There were a lot. We got into package tours where we'd open for other major artists. And so we'd run on and do half an hour of our own stuff and then we'd run off again. And it was just gig after gig after gig. It was like, it was being in the army for a band. You learned what it was like to be on the road. But the biggest thing we ever did was quite a lot later. We, for better or for worse, we got involved with Billy Graham's people. Okay. As you can imagine, I mean, Billy Graham's like the Pope of America.
Mm-hmm.
We always used to say, I mean, he's a cultural icon, whether you're a Christian or not. He's Billy Graham, right? And we did this thing in New York City at Meadowlands, and it turns out that there were 100,000 people in front of us. Mayor of New York, Bill and Hillary Clinton, and these three oaks from Durban in the back row going, who's that? And we got on stage, and you look out in this audience and you go, your brain just can't compute. There were 100,000 people. It's too big. It's so much better to play those little sweaty 30 people in London somewhere in a little pub.
Mm.
But we did some huge things. We did some small things. I can't think of one that stuck out. There were some great times. But it was a blur.
How long did you play for with Bill and Hillary there?
Bill and Hillary.
I don't think she knew what was going to happen in a couple of years' time, huh?
We literally sat a row behind her, and I remember looking at the cracks in her heels and thinking, wow, Hillary Clinton's got cracks in her heels. That's amazing.
And now she's
about
running.
To be.
Yeah. Amazing. Monica Lewinsky, she wasn't in the crowd.
She was under the seat.
That's what I like about you, your sense of humor. But being in America, the setup there, when it comes, you know, as far as music shops are concerned and producers,
wow.
The setup there, People, those are their careers for the rest of their lives. Most of those people are musicians, and you can survive. It's tough,
totally.
But also, you go on a tour there. You can tour for a year, and you won't cover America.
The thing exactly is, in America, there's a gig every night if you want it. You just have to say yes to it. There's so much space. 300 million people. There's little clubs everywhere. You could, if you get in a car and do it yourself, you will never stop. And that's what's so attractive about it. Also, you can buy a lot with $1. So if you earn $30 at a gig, you can get by.
Mm.
But like you say, in Nashville, every second suburban house is a studio in it. And there's a guy who's really ridiculously good at programming or editing, or, you know, it's that town draws all the talent to it. Nashville's a transit town. No one's actually born in Nashville. They all leave, and all these foreigners come in from Ohio and whatever. I never met one person in Nashville in all those years we lived there who was actually born in Nashville. They were all from somewhere else. But it was great, an amazing community of people who always had ideas and gear, and it was just a very stimulating environment.
Did they love your accent?
Yeah, they thought we were, what, are you Scottish? Are you Russian or something? No, South African. Oh, Africa, do you know Steve? We're like, no.
And, you know, obviously, how long were you there for? Because you were also saying to yourself, we have to go back to South Africa. We have to tour again. And you used to come at you quite often and then do major shows. Somebody saw you at the, where was it? The Butrosky.
Oh, in Bloom.
In Bloom, yeah. Somebody said they saw you there live and it was a brilliant show. So, I mean, when you came back, when the press got behind you in South Africa and all the radio stations, interviews, people went crazy. What was it like coming back as big rock stars that you've now sort of made it big? You won that Dove Award. Yeah. We'll explain what that is all about a little later on. But what was it like getting back and to play for sold out shows? You did anyway before you left South Africa, but coming back must have been quite amazing, huh?
It was, and it actually was a little bit embarrassing because, like I said earlier, that Durbanness never leaves. Mm. I'm just a netter oak from Durbanoff. And you have that small town mentality of, come on, Oaks, man, I'm just an oak from the beach. And you're treated as, wow, you've really achieved this amazing stuff in your career in a foreign country. And for the story of South Africa, it's a big deal when, especially in those days, when a local band had done well. But you never lose the fact that you're from a small town. And so you always feel like, it's not me.
But I mean, I remember Billboard magazine. It was just, we used to go crazy. We used to get, we subscribed to the Billboard magazine, the radio station. And there's a story on page 363. I can't believe it.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I mean, and we were so proud of you then.
Wow.
So, I mean, the Dove Award, can you explain to everybody what that is? It's got nothing to do with soap or anything or deodorant or whatever they call it, or powder or whatever. But nobody knows. But it's the equivalent of a Grammy Award, right?
For some reason, the Christian music community, I understand it, but it's a human nature thing to award each other.
Bonnie and Friends. Bonnie Simon.